They want to put an American-type democracy. They think that if they can put that anywhere in by force, that's fine. There's a Boston University professor, Andrew Bacevich, said that it's like Woodrow Wilson combined with the elder Field Marshal von Moltke in its implementation.
Real patriots love their country enough to want to improve it, and their patriotism has a social content, and that social content is social justice.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, September 30th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The Justice Department has launched a full-blown criminal investigation into who leaked the name of a CIA officer, and President Bush directed his White House staff today to fully cooperate. The staff was notified of the investigation by email after the Justice Department decided late yesterday to move from a preliminary investigation into a full probe. It is rare that the department decides to conduct a full investigation of an alleged leak of classified information. White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez told the staff, quote, "You must preserve all materials that might in any way be related to the department's investigation. Presumably that would include telephone logs, emails, notes, and other documents," he said. The disclosure of the intelligence officer's identity by syndicated columnist Robert Novak came shortly after her husband, former Ambassador Joseph C. Wilson, undermined Bush's claim that Iraq had tried to buy uranium in Africa. In what turned out to be a major embarrassment, Bush acknowledged he could not back up his statement. Wilson's wife was outed as a CIA agent shortly after Wilson's statement. A spokesman for the president of Iraq's governing council said today the Iraqis are unlikely to adopt a new constitution within 6 months as proposed by Secretary of State Colin Powell. Intifad Khanbar, spokesperson for Ahmed Chalabi, who currently holds the council's rotating presidency, said that although everyone wants to see a new constitution as soon as possible, it would take time for Iraqis to coalesce on the framework for a new democratic Iraq. They also had to be adequate time for Iraqis to discuss and understand any proposed constitution before holding a referendum, Khanbar said. A U.S. envoy came under attack today on a bridge in northern Baghdad, and one soldier was slightly injured when an explosive was thrown or fired from a passing car, according to witnesses. In western Baghdad, one American soldier drowned and another was missing after a vehicle overturned in a canal yesterday as troops were responding to a reported mortar attack. That's according to the U.S. Central Command. President Bush has come under renewed criticism for his close ties to a new corporation poised to take advantage of lucrative business opportunities in Iraq. According to the company's website, Newbridge Strategies LLC is a unique company that was created specifically with the aim of assisting clients to evaluate and take advantage of business opportunities in the Middle East following the conclusion of the U.S.-led war in Iraq. Its activities will seek to expedite the creation of free and fair markets and new economic growth in Iraq, consistent with the policies of the Bush administration. The opportunities evolving in Iraq today are of such an unprecedented nature and scope that no other existing firm has the necessary skills and experience to be effective both in the United States and on the ground in Iraq. Of particular concern to some critics of the administration is the fact that the chairman and director of Newbridge is Joe Alba, President Bush's longtime right-hand man and, until about 6 months ago, the head of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Before that, Alba served as Bush's chief of staff when he was governor of Texas, and he was campaign manager for the Bush-Cheney 2000 campaign. Increasingly, criticism of the Bush administration and specifically its policies in Iraq is coming from people outside of traditional democratic and peace activist circles. Recent polls have indicated that the president's overall approval rating has dropped to its lowest point since the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2 years ago. A USA Today CNN Gallup poll taken earlier this month shows that barely more than half of Americans approve of Bush's on-the-job rating. And if the election were held today, he would hold only a 4-point lead over a yet-to-be-named Democratic rival. Of particular concern to Republican strategists is the growing disenchantment with Bush, even among much of his usual conservative base of support. According to a recent survey of American voters, nearly a quarter of self-described conservatives nationwide gave a thumbs down to the president. One such critic has even created a website, conservativesagainstbush.com, to, quote, "propound the conservative principles this administration has forsaken," end quote. Peace Watch spoke recently with Daniel Craig, the creator of the site.
What really tipped it for me was the Iraq War, which was really a radical policy. It was, there's nothing conservative about it. He bought into this neoconservative notion that is kind of Wilsonianism taken to an extreme, that we can democratize the Middle East just by sweeping into Iraq, and then everybody will love us. And we're seeing right now that that's not the case, and we didn't increase our security. When we were fighting in the middle of a war on terror against fundamentalist Islam, we're going and taking in a secular state, which was bad to its people, but there weren't any terrorists coming out of Iraq.
And so you have also created a website, conservativesagainstbush.com, and mm-hmm. I know your group is sort of new and small at this point, but is it growing, and do you get the sense that there are many Americans who share your conservative politics but are also increasingly frustrated with the president, particularly over his handling of the war and the occupation of Iraq?
Definitely. I've been getting hundreds of emails. On Monday, we had 60,000 hits. You know, and I mean, we're still getting some detractor emails, some that, you know, say, you know, this is just a, you know, a liberal conspiracy here or whatever, but I'm getting a lot and a lot of well-thought-out, serious emails from conservatives who are not happy with this administration and are not going to vote for him, and they may vote for a Democrat or they may stay home.
And so did you support the invasion of Iraq?
No, not at all. I don't think neoconservatism is really part of conservatism. I mean, it's they were former Democrats that jumped ship back in the 60s, and I don't support their notions of foreign policy. They have think there are limits to U.S. power, and then they think that the American form of government is right for all peoples, no matter where they are, at what stage of development, or whether, you know, they like America even.
And so you disagree with the group around the president now that subscribes to this neoconservative policy.
Right. They're mostly in the Defense Department. You know, Paul Wolfowitz is the ranking guy in there, but Rumsfeld bought into it, even though he's not part of their intellectual clique, and Cheney also bought into it. Even after he had written the original guidance for the first Gulf War, saying the problems we could experience if we went to Baghdad, and he laid out exactly all the problems that we're experiencing right now. But throughout the 90s, before there was ever a problem with Saddam kicking the inspectors out, Wolfowitz and the rest of the neocons were saying that we should go in to occupy Iraq to democratize the Middle East.
And so maybe we should just take a step back to define this term for listeners who might be a little bit confused. You're saying the neoconservatives. How does that philosophy or ideology, brand of ideology, differ from the old brand of political conservatism, in your opinion?
The major foreign policy intellectuals that were kind of founded by Irving Kristol, who, if you know, Bill Kristol, the editor of the Weekly Standard, was his father, and Leo Strauss, a University of Chicago professor. And they tend to kind of see the world in moralistic terms and think that they don't exactly recognize limits to U.S. power, and they think we should use our power to kind of create the world kind of in our image. They say they want to put an American-type democracy. They think that if they can put that anywhere in by force, that's fine. There's a Boston University professor, Andrew Bacevich, said that it's like Woodrow Wilson combined with the elder Field Marshal von Moltke in its implementation.
So many have said that this sort of neocon group, junta, has hijacked the administration's foreign policy. Would you agree with that characterization? Do you feel that there are more Republicans or conservatives that side with the old traditional conservatism, or more that are buying into this new neoconservative ideology?
When people signed on to this, when they supported the Iraq War, they knew who was kind of running the show, because it's a real small Washington intellectual clique. And to say, I mean, they controlled this policy, but even worse than that, they've been guiding our foreign policy from the Defense Department, because they're not in the State Department. Colin Powell was against this, and the State Department bureaucracy was against it. The serving officers in the armed force were against it, but they managed to get a hold of the president by kind of cooking up their own intelligence, and they couldn't get the CIA or the Defense Intelligence Agency to sign off on it, but they took it directly to him anyways. And then they had their think tanks, namely the American Enterprise Institute, reinforce this on the president. So he was getting a lot of bad advice, and he bought into it.
Where do you think Bush went wrong, specifically with regard to Iraq, and what would have been a more appropriate course of action for him to have taken, in your opinion?
His first problem is not understanding exactly the conflict that we're in, you know, the war on terrorism, and that we're fighting, we're not fighting states, we're fighting these non-state actors, these fundamental Islamists, and there are limits to our power. going in and occupying Iraq cuts off a large amount of our ability. There are 10 divisions in the Army right now. Within the next 6 months to a year, 9 of those divisions will either be being deployed or coming back from deployment. So our hands are kind of tied right now. There were Al-Qaeda camps in Syria and Lebanon. You know, there's some Al-Qaeda in Iran. You know, there's Al-Qaeda, you know, all over the world except for basically Iraq. So he goes after the one country in the Middle East which was, you know, run by a bad guy, but the world is 80% dictators. And we don't go around deposing dictators just because they're bad guys. We supported Saddam in the 80s. So he's misused our resources in prosecuting this war.
Mm. Well, the anti-war activist group MoveOn.org has launched an ad campaign featuring a military parent, Larry Siverson. And Mr. Siverson is quoted as saying, "I'm a patriotic American with 3 sons in the military, 2 serving in Iraq, but the leaders they serve have not acted honorably. They have failed my sons. They have failed all of us. At the very least, Donald Rumsfeld must go." Do you share Mr. Siverson's sentiment calling for the removal of the Secretary of Defense? You seem to blame the neocon group within the administration for taking the country in this direction.
Sure, I would agree with that sentiment because Rumsfeld, he bought into it, and he's also responsible, he's the one who's largely responsible for the occupation problem that we have right now because he also bought into a lot of unproven doctrines about the revolution and military affairs, and he's the one who said that we wouldn't need all these troops to occupy the country. He thinks that we can do things kind of on the cheap with less people, and that isn't bore out by any historical analogy. He's probably the person most responsible for the problems with the occupation now, even though the neocons were the architects of this, you know, idea.
And so just how disappointed and angry and, you know, disenfranchised or not disenfranchised, but how upset are you with the president given the upcoming elections in November 2004? Are you likely to support him nonetheless?
No, there's no way I could support him unless he did something, you know, completely radical, like, you know, fired Cheney, Rumsfeld, and eliminated the neocon influence and gave Colin Powell control over foreign policy. That's the only reason I'd even consider it. But at this point, I mean, I'm just so frustrated that I'm going to vote for a Democrat.
You will vote for a Democrat?
Probably.
Any favorites so far?
You know, I'd like to vote for the most moderate candidate. And I don't know if that's Wesley Clark or not. I haven't seen enough of him. A moderate Democrat is better than a radical radical Republican that's not being conservative.
What kind of response have you received since setting up your website? Has anyone thought that perhaps you're really a Democrat attempting to weaken Republican support of Bush?
Yeah, we get a few of those emails. They're a lot less than the number of conservatives who are saying that they really like the website, who say that, you know, this is just us trying to weaken conservative support, but I tell them that I've never voted for a Democrat before, and I've been a conservative all my life, so that's all I can say.
Mm-hmm. And so you said there were 60,000 hits on your website
on Monday.
On
that
Monday?
Was our biggest day. Yeah, we had 50,000 the day before that on Sunday.
Was that tied to the UN speech?
I think after the Star Tribune article, we started getting posted to a number of different sites, and I couldn't even keep track of them all because people didn't tell me when they did think. But I think we got posted to a couple big sites on Sunday, and that carried on over to Monday.
Mm-hmm. And what are people saying mostly?
They're saying that they really like the message that where people are speaking up, and they're not blindly following the president on this. Because there's been kind of this undercurrent recently that you shouldn't question the president in wartime, you know, and that, if my before I put up this site, you know, family members warned me, you know, that I'm going to get an FBI file, and that, of course, you know, made me run out and do it faster, but no, I'm not going to be arrested for sedition anytime soon. But it's too bad that conservatives feel they have a monopoly on patriotism, because I know we criticized Clinton for 8 years for everything he did.
You're also worried about certain limitations on civil liberties that have come as a result of the post-September 11th legislation, like the USA
Definitely.
Patriot Act. Can you expound on that? What are your concerns there?
Well, the biggest concern, I guess, is about John Ashcroft, who seems rather intolerant. And these aren't necessarily just conservative values. These are universal American values for civil liberties. And it's not just the problems with the Patriot Act, but he's doing other things. Like there was a guy who was protesting at a South Carolina airport where George Bush was going to land, and he had a No War for Oil sign up. And he was arrested for trespassing, and he'd been arrested 30 years ago for the same thing, except different war, different president. And so that was dismissed. But then the Justice Department came at him under an obscure law that says that the Secret Service can restrict access to the president, and said that he should have been in a designated free speech zone miles away from where the president was. Of course, the president's supporters could come right up to him. And this guy, you know, said that the whole of U.S. was a free speech zone. But they're, as far as I know, they're still trying to prosecute him for this. Mm. And that's just, it's absurd.
Mm. Would you say that many of the visitors to your website are inclined to vote for someone other than Bush? I think many analysts are predicting that even though there may be this growing disenchantment with President Bush, most are going to just vote for him anyway because they don't have anybody else to vote for, in their opinion.
I think if Clark can stay moderate enough, I think that you might have a lot of crossover. We have been contacted by the Republicans for Dean. I don't know how big they are, but because he's been conservative on some things. He's been a budget hawk, you know, and he's pro-gun, stuff like that. But I really think it will hinge on Wesley Clark's candidacy. But I think a lot of conservatives might stay home, too.
Just not vote.
Just not vote.
Daniel Craig is the creator of the website conservativesagainstbush.com. Many of the conservatives who do support the president and the war effort have traditionally branded critics unpatriotic and un-American. Today, we present Michael Parenti speaking about super patriotism, real patriotism, and the importance of being number one. Parenti's books include Democracy for the Few, Against Empire, and Dirty Truths. His speech was delivered in Boulder, Colorado, back in 1988, and was produced by People's Video Audio.
Well, as a guest on radio talk shows, I have on a number of occasions criticized U.S. foreign policy. And one time an irate caller called in and he said to me, do you love your country? And the question was obviously rhetorical, because here was someone who saw fit to question my patriotism because I was questioning the policies of our leaders. It's really strange when you think about it. The caller was manifesting a symptom of what might be called super patriotism, also sometimes called stupor patriotism, also called pseudo patriotism, a phenomenon best defined as the willingness to follow our leaders uncritically in all their dealings with other nations, especially when those dealings are confrontational and belligerent and they involve a question of national pride or the use of military force. That's the definition of super patriotism. This super patriotism or American chauvinism has been with us throughout much of our history. And whether or not it's the last refuge of scoundrels, as Dr. Johnson would say, it certainly is a very effective instrument in discouraging and discrediting critical public discourse. Well, I think it's time that the super patriots account for their brand of patriotism and has explained to us what it's all about. For instance, what do they mean when they say they love their country? What do they mean by country? You know, academia is not totally without certain virtues. You learn to ask a lot of trivial, detailed questions in any case. So I asked myself, what do you mean by country? Do they love every region and locale in the United States? Well, obviously, very few of us have been to every region and locale, and nor would all of us find all the regions and locales all that lovable. Does love of country mean loving the American people? Well, again, even the most gregarious among us have met only a relatively small portion of the American people. And I would bet that these super patriots don't particularly love whole sectors of the American public, especially the more bigoted super patriots. In fact, rather dislike to associate with or have any positive identification with certain people because of reasons of ethnicity, religion, race, and class. Do super patriots love America for its history and culture? Again, I'm really skeptical of that because it's my impression that they know very little about American history and culture, or rather, much of it is rather unappreciated by them. Furthermore, there's a terrible side to our history that's really not all that lovable. For instance, the extermination of Native American Indian nations, the enslavement of African people, the aggressive wars against Vietnam, Mexico, Canada, We lost 1,000 men on one attack on Canada. I just learned a little while ago. Central America, the Philippines, and elsewhere. Nor might we all be that enamored with certain aspects of American culture, certainly not the mind abuse of primetime television, the commercialism, the corporate greed, the ecological devastation, the economic and racial injustice. If I'm being asked to prove my patriotism by loving American popular culture, then I might fail the test, I guess. Well, the America that the super patriots claim to love is neither a geographical totality, nor is it a vast population, nor is it really a history or culture. As far as I can see, their America, and they say love America, is an ideological abstraction. It's an emotive symbol that can be embodied in other abstract symbols like the flag. It's sort of almost a love without content. I mean, how else can you love a flag? I mean, a flag, as you know, is a piece of rag on a stick, and it's got colors and things. And if you love that flag, and that flag's a symbol of your country, it's a kind of love that doesn't seem to have a content to it. Well, having said that, let me contradict myself, because there is one real content to the super patriotism. Its main substance is militarism. The pacifist and political scientist and activist, by the way, good pacifists are all not passive, they're pacifists, and they're quite active. The pacifist and activist, Milford Sibley, he once noted, quote, "Patriotism for most professional patriots seems to be inseparably connected with military violence and war." Indeed, the most militaristic among us seem to think that they are the most patriotic. Isn't that rather extraordinary? Patriotic virtues are equated with military ones. Our history's patriotic vignettes are usually military ones. Valley Forge, the Alamo, Gettysburg, the battleship Maine, Pearl Harbor, raising the flag on Iwo Jima, D-Day, the MIAs and POWs, and the like. Our country, right or wrong, but mostly our country at war or ready for war. The commemorations of our national leaders during national holidays would be incomplete without the marching troops, the weapon displays, martial music, formations of fighter planes zooming overhead. Even in local communities, when they organize patriotic celebrations, the marching bands usually appear in semi-martial uniforms, the high school cadets with rifles on their shoulders, and if there's an army base nearby, even troops. I remember once sitting in Urbana, Illinois, July 4th, watching this parade come by, and on this float was suddenly this missile, sort of small missile, but there was this instrument of death on this float that was going by, and there were some people around me, and you know what they did? They started to applaud this inanimate object. I mean, there wasn't even a pilot or, you know, somebody else tending to it, or a soldier striding it and waving and going, "Yow, look at me," you know. I mean, it was too much for me. They were just applauding this weapon. And a little jet fighter came by on the float, and they started applauding that, too. This was at a time when these things were being used in Vietnam. Well, even July 4th fireworks sometimes are really a benign representation or replication of the rockets' red glare, the bombs bursting in air, as the top patriotic song on our patriotic hit parade goes. Max Weber once said that the state's irreducible characteristic is a monopoly on the legitimate use of violence. And to be sure, state ceremonies in most states include some display of military force. Now, the way super patriots express their national pride leaves me uncomfortable. It seems the love we are to have for our country rests on some kind of competition with other countries, that it comes at an expense with other countries. It's a love that is predicated on some invidious comparison to other countries being lesser, being not as good. If we love our country, we have to believe it's better than any other. The super patriots will even ask us, "Don't you think this is the best country in the world?" So that you love it because it's better. It's, you know, it's something better. This, by the way, we might recognize immediately as the being number one syndrome. I guess I must have heard about being number one for a long time, but the first time it ever stuck in my mind was when I heard President Richard Nixon sometime in the late 60s announce, and I quote, "America is still number one." And the "still," of course, you know, hints at some anxiety that there might be some slippage there. So I'm listening to this and I'm saying, okay, number one, that's, hey, number one, that makes me feel, you know, makes me feel like number one, and that's pretty good. But I was bothered by it because it presumed that we were in some kind of adversarial relationship to other nations, all other countries, and that somehow our greatness and our goodness could only be measured in comparison to them, only in our ability to be the top banana. So I said, all right, we're number one. And then one of those troublesome questions came again in my head, and I said, if we're number one, what are we number one in? I mean, what are you number one in? So I thought, I said, population? And then, no, the Chinese walk away with all the awards in that category. Geography? No, I think the Soviets and even Canada has more real estate than we do. We're not number one in size. I mean, Brazil is a number of countries, I think. I don't even want to think about it, about all the countries that might be ahead of us there. Steel production and other basic industries? I perked up a little. Well, we used to be number one in that, but we have slipped down the list because our super patriot corporate leaders have taken to abandoning our communities and exporting our jobs and bringing the factories off to Taiwan and Argentina and South Korea, where they can work for slave labor wages. Which, when you think about it, is not the way for super patriots to act, really, you know, take our factories away and all that. So I said, well, what are we number one? Are we number one in cuisine? Please, please. I mean, in that category, we are strictly double digits. Way behind, you know, France, China, Japan, Mexico, Italy, India, Greece, and others. Are we number one in trade? I know we used to be number one in trade, but I believe the Japanese have outstripped us, or so it would seem to anybody who's walked into any department store in the last couple of years. So the question remains, I was sitting there saying, well, what are we number one in? You know? And the best I can tell from the super patriotic utterances is that it gets down to two things. One, wealth. With no concern as to how the wealth is distributed and how it's used and for what effects. And military power. With no concern, again, with how that military power is used and for whose interests that it might serve at home and abroad. A few years ago, President Reagan exclaimed, quote, "We are proud of America. We love America. America is the greatest." Now, the greatest, and when you say America is the greatest, that's another way of saying number one. America is number one. Now, supposedly, we can love America and be proud of our country because it's so great. The implication is, however, that if it weren't so great, it wouldn't be so lovable. And that began to trouble me. The super patriot's love of country seems predicated on the country's being up there, stronger and superior to other countries. What happens if it's going to slip? What happens? I started thinking, really, what about people from lesser lands, as we might call them? I mean, what about somebody from Luxembourg? I mean, now Luxembourg is number 122, you know. I mean, just barely ahead of San Marino in its military might. I said, what does someone from Luxembourg do? Do they go around shame-faced like this, you know? They say, you from Luxembourg? You from Luxembourg? I said, no, I'm French. No, I'm French. And you say, do you love your country? You know, they say, well, what is there to love? I mean, a few border police, no army, no navy. I mean, it's a...
Michael Parenti, speaking in Boulder, Colorado. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.